This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff, and we are now at episode 11. And I am excited because we are doing another therapist's roundtable. We have Bryson and Veronica back in studio. And I'm especially excited because we're adding a fourth member to our roundtable, another colleague of ours at the PhD program at Loma Linda University, Lauren Foster. Welcome, Lauren.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. Just maybe really quickly for our listeners, can you maybe share a little bit about your background and what you're up to?
Sure. So like Chris said, I am a marriage and family therapy student at Loma Linda University in my third year. So hopefully wanting to finish that up soon, with great interest in working with those in underserved communities. So really those with poverty issues, larger socioeconomic issues as well. That's basically where I'm at. Was trained at Drexel University for my master's and Spelman College for my undergrad.
Awesome. And we're gonna lean on you a little bit for your Drexel experience in a bit, but you're also a writing partner of mine.
Absolutely.
We're doing an article together. I owe you some edits.
Yes, you do.
Yeah, so, I'll get those to you. We're writing an article around spirituality and resilience, and so excited to get that finished.
Yes.
So Bryson and Veronica, hello, I should probably say.
Hi.
Hey.
Okay.
Thank you for having us back.
Yeah, welcome. So, we chat a lot offline, so we are always wondering what we should be talking about. And the last time we came together, I think afterwards, we were kind of, we should do a person of the therapist or self of the therapist episode, and which I thought was important. I was reading an article recently too, and they were kind of pointing out a gap in the literature around. I think there was some talk about the use of the self of the therapist with like Bowen and Satir and those kinds of things. And even Freud with his ideas around a training therapist should be doing psychoanalysis as not to harm their clients, that kind of thing. And then I think there was it kind of fell off, and there wasn't a lot of talk about it. And then a lot of the literature was around models, et cetera, and techniques and what have you. And then I think in the mid 2000s, or it was early 2000s, Harry Aponte wrote, I'm going to say,
early 2000s,
early was first article on the person of the therapist training. Dr. Harry Aponte out of Drexel University, and I think that has kind of restarted some literature in, person of the therapist or self of the therapist work, and we're all doing supervision now, and and I think, and at least in the supervising I'm doing, it's vitally important, this kind of work. I find myself sometimes trying to talk training therapists out of giving up on being a therapist, and just because of some of these ideas that are floating around on what makes a good therapist and all that kind of stuff, which we'll talk about in a bit. But Lauren, I wanted to ask you, I'm going to read kind of the three goals of training new therapists that Harry Aponte had written, and then maybe I'm going to ask you about your experience at Drexel and what it was like learning that. So Dr. Aponte's first basic goal of training new therapists is that therapists must know themselves, particularly the dominant personal challenges, psychological, cultural, and spiritual, that mark their lives, and know their history and their current status with their challenges, their psychological, cultural, spiritual challenges. That's the first task, this kind of knowing ourselves. And the second task is this: therapist must have the ability to observe, have access to, and exercise judgment that springs from their own personal themes while in the actual drama of therapy. Meaning that this idea of really paying attention to what's going on with us, right? While we're in the actual, I like that language, the drama of therapy. And then the third goal is that therapists must manage all the emotional, cultural, and spiritual forces operating on them. So three important goals in at least the person of the therapist training. And so, and you trained under that umbrella at Drexel. So would you share a little bit about what that was like?
Sure. So how the person of the therapist training works at Drexel is that it's a three-quarter sort of class. And the first quarter you establish a signature theme. So it is sort of what that key thing is that sort of ties itself through your clinical work, your professional life, and then what history you have with that particular theme. And the good thing about Drexel is because person of the therapist is essential to what we're doing, it goes into every single one of your classes. So every class that you have to talk about this signature theme, like where it's coming up for you, how it's showing up as you're learning structural, as you're learning narrative, like what that looks like and how that's going to be interacted with for yourself and for the clients as well.
Could you, for our listeners, just give us some examples of themes, not your own?
I can share my own. I have no problem doing that. Okay. So I think when I first started at Drexel, my signature theme was around perfection or the appearance as such. So I looked at all of my journals and like it was all throughout that. So some other signature themes were just around vulnerability, being able to be vulnerable, having this fear of being dependent on other people. Really just those sorts of things, just really around vulnerability that people have that they don't necessarily want to share or convey with people, with others.
And that perfection piece is so debilitating, I think, in some ways. It's so influential in some way in us as new therapists. Mm-hmm. Right?
So today before the podcast, I was going back and we were to like journal after every single class we had. And in reading the journals, I could see it like throughout everything I was writing, like this thing about perfection and me being like very boxed in with it, I guess, and it really being debilitating because I didn't know what to do with it, how to work with it, how that was going to look for my clients. And then part of the goals are to really have you visualize and see what that impact is going to be on your clients. And so I think I was able to predict early on that it would have me sort of being in my head and it wouldn't allow me to be present with my clients. And so it was something that I wanted to work on. But I was able to recognize it pretty early on. And I think it helped my process immensely because I think definitely as a new therapist coming in, that feeling of I have to get this right now, I have to say the right thing at the right time, can really sort of paralyze you, and then you don't know really what to do, what to say, and where to go from there.
For sure. Okay, so signature theme was important.
Signature theme was majorly important, okay. Yes.
And then what was next?
And then, so basically, the first quarter of the class, you were presenting that signature theme. And then you were presenting the history of the theme, how it tied into your current clinical work. And so at that point, nobody was really doing a lot of clinical work. So it was really how you thought it was going to come up clinically and how you were going to use that and how it shows up personally as well. So you were to present that with the class, and Dr. Aponte and one of the doctoral students would work with you and sort of help you to figure things out, and would very quickly, because he is 40 years into the field, can very easily go to that sort of soft space for you, whatever that particular issue was, he was able to sort of zero in on it and work with you a little bit with that, and to recommend maybe you need to look at this, or maybe this is something that you would like to work on in the future. And so that's basically where everyone started from. And then the subsequent two quarters were really around how you're going to actually do this with clients. And so we had actors. We were fortunate we had actors come in. And they were a family, a couple, whatever. And so you got to go in and work with this client, work with whoever was in there, and you had little earbuds in, and you were able to be coached with him, but use your own experience and what you're going through and your own signature theme and what you really come into the room with, and to work with these clients. And so it was a really good experience because you got two quarters of that sort of continuous, like, how are you going to use yourself? How are you going to be a part of this? Because anytime you step into a room, you're going to be there, and all of your stuff is going to be there with you. So how do you use that in the best possible way?
Yeah. How were these signature themes kind of deconstructed, I guess? Were they located culturally, or how were they? Because I'm wondering how you kind of avoid that kind of therapist deficit talk, right? Mm. Yeah. And so, and I'm wondering how that was handled.
Yeah. So again, with Drexel, person of the therapist was a big piece, as well as social justice. So they attended to a lot of like larger social issues, larger social discourses. So, yes, most of that was located in the history of one's culture, one's religion, what that experience may mean for one person. So for me, my experience of perfectionism was really rooted in some of my own religious experience, some of my cultural background. And I had a classmate who had a similar signature theme, but was not rooted in those two things at all. And so because we are two different people and we have two unique experiences of the world, that's how that particular piece was shaped. So, and he did a very good job. He and the doctoral students that worked with him did a great job of locating that. And that had to be a part of your initial presentation of what that signature theme was and how it sort of comes up for you.
Yeah. And the history of it and where it was. Okay. Mm-hmm. How about you, Veronica? I don't know if it was probably language's signature theme, but I should probably just even go back to the start. Was there any in your training, kind of self of the therapist or person of the therapist work being done, or?
I don't remember. I hope none of my instructors listen to this podcast. Right. But you know, for me, I don't know that it was so explicit that it was a conversation that was had, I guess, in a few of my classes, but it was sort of like, and as therapists, we consider ourselves in the room, but it didn't really go much into that. And then I think I've shared this on a different podcast, but one of my very memorable experiences was an instructor saying, if you want to make any money, you need to know CBT. And so for me, the fear of the impending student loans was like, well, I'm going to do CBT because I need to get paid. And so a lot of my person of the therapist, self of the therapist knowledge was then based in those theories, which eventually rubbed me the wrong way and didn't sit well with how I wanted to be with my clients, which is what made me pursue the advanced degree at Loma Linda with a more social justice lens.
Okay. And then that's when you begin to have more of these kinds of conversations in different ways.
Yeah, because I remember even in my internship, so between my master's and my doctoral program, I worked for CalWORKs, and there was not much conversation about self of the therapist. And I was working with a population that was really challenging. It was a multi-stressed population, and there was no conversation about how are you showing up in the room? What judgments do you have? And at that point, because of my family experience, pretty conservative Republican law enforcement, I think that I had a lot of judgments about people who were involved with the criminal justice system and people who had severe mental illness that I think showed up in ways that felt incongruent with how I experienced my clients, but I didn't know what to do with that. And so that's really what sort of prompted me to go back and learn more and to want to be different in the therapy room.
Great. How about you, Bryson?
Yeah, I guess I'm just in hearing everybody talk, I can sort of relate to the difference in experiences, and I maybe fall somewhere in between that. I do think that maybe, like Lauren, it wasn't as explicit, or I guess Lauren's program at Drexel was far more explicit in probably addressing or making that like a real sort of pinnacle of the work, the self of the therapist issues, where I certainly remember it coming up and us having opportunities to talk about it, and sort of always encouraged to have that discussion about who you are bringing into the room, not just your, you know, who your client is bringing in, but who you are showing up, how you're, you know, the different things that you're attending to. Some of the conversations I would have that would fall on the sort of self of the therapist side would be things like exploring different decision points, you know, what not just clinically or model driven, but like who you are as a person. How did you choose to go down this path with a client over another one? Or how did you attune to this portion of what the client was talking about? And were you aware that this other portion was, you know, available in that decision point? So that was probably how the training was early on. And then I think through supervision, I trained under a psychodynamic therapist. And so there was quite a bit of self of the therapist that would come up as a part of those supervisions, and certainly the pursuit of perfection I can relate to. And my phrase is the pursuit of perfection only brings paralysis, because I feel like when I find myself in pursuit of perfection, I feel very stuck. I feel very guarded or reserved, or, you know, I almost feel different. I won't put myself out there in the same way. So I know that shows up for me. And you know, the other thought that I had, the other sort of part of me right now that's coming up, is just thinking about self of the therapist as a developmental process, and how I think for a lot of students and maybe a lot of programs, there is a real investment in teaching therapy and crisis management and models and things like this, to where self of the therapist might be something at like the 3, 4, 5 year mark that starts to become more like salient in the discussions and things. So I feel like that's probably been my experience. Early on, it was nowhere near as much of a conversation as it was, you know, in the last few years. And I think that's part of that's just developmental. And
you know, a couple of you have brought up this idea of perfection, and I'm wondering how you take it on as supervisors, because it has this really detrimental influence on new trainees, and I'm running into it all the time, and it just really takes any joy out of the work, right? And so I guess I want to throw that out there. Before I do that, I want to kind of share my experience as well. It was never called self of the therapist. We never really talked about it in my master's training as well, although we were tasked to be critically reflective, meaning, you know, the power, attending to the power of the therapist and kind of how larger social discourse operates in the world, and how we were to not kind of reproduce that in the therapy room. So there was some critical, we were tasked to be very critically reflective, but also in some ways that can be pretty destabilizing as a new trainee, you know, and I'm wondering, you know, I discovered you have to really create a space or a holding environment or like a safe space or something, so people can really sort these things out, you know. And I think sometimes we ask people to be, and we'll get there in a little bit, pretty critically reflective without really doing the self of the therapist work, as well as they're struggling with these ideas and being introduced to privilege and all these kinds of things. So, but I want to go back to that perfection question. How are you? I know you're all supervising. I know you're all supervising new trainees. And I know you're running into it as well. I mean, what are your strategies to help new trainees get this kind of distance from that perfection so they do not suffer that paralysis that you talked about?
I guess it's interesting you choose the word distance. For me, I maybe think about it as how do they actually lean in and start to experience it, right? So I don't think about it as how do we get away from perfection, but how do we recognize it, lean into it, use it in some way, understand it? So I think at least the ways right now that are coming to mind are, I have pretty open and explicit conversations about it. And I'll use my person of the therapist, my journey, my sort of experience, I think, to try and help create that safe space that, you know, I can certainly show up in vulnerable ways, and then hopefully that can help elicit some vulnerability, some self-disclosure, because I think once it's out in the open, you can actually work with it. If it stays covert and for some reason there is a idea that it's not acceptable to talk about or bring out, it's much harder to work with it.
For sure.
Yeah. I think this has been something I struggle with. I wear two hats. So I teach at the same institution where I supervise, and I teach my supervisees. And so, and the classes that I teach challenge the students, most of them say it's their hardest classes. They take their research classes. And so this idea of perfection and not getting it is really palpable in those classes. And then I've struggled with how do I then bring that into supervision in a way that's impacting their clinical practice, but then also impacting how they are in the classroom too. Because I don't know that perfectionism just shows up in one place for them. And so as a supervisor, I feel a bit of a responsibility to sort of go there in sort of how it shows up in all their areas of their life. Because I think they all impact and intersect with one another, right? If I'm not feeling good enough, or if I'm not meeting the mark here, then when I show up to be with my client and I'm feeling that level of not being enough, that can then show up with the client. So I've been really trying to navigate those conversations, but I don't know if I'm doing them well. I'm trying to go there though, and trying to go there in a maybe more explicit way, in an intentional way, that offers other opportunities for things other than perfection. Because I know from my own experience, it's those moments when I've just said, wow, this is really heavy. I just need to take a breath for a moment in session, that, you know, sort of that being authentic and not knowing, like, I really don't know what to say right now. Like, this is really heavy, what you've just said. That those moments of not knowing have been the most therapeutically relevant. And so really trying to share that with my students in a way that doesn't, like, lecture, like, this is what you should do, but that just saying, like, there's other opportunities when you're in those moments to use that perfectionism in a way that's really therapeutically useful.
Yeah. I like the idea of making it explicit, and the fact that it always does show up in multiple places. I don't think if for whatever reason you show up as being sort of perfectionistic when you're with clients, that it's not going to show up academically, that it's not going to show up in your personal life. So I think by making it explicit, I think that really is helpful. Especially if you do so clinically, like, okay, well, if you miss something here, it's going to show up again if it's really relevant for your client. Just like if it's relevant for you, you're going to talk about it again, right? Like, so if I miss something in supervision, my supervisee is definitely going to bring it up again because that's an issue that they want to address. So the client would then do the exact same thing if they really want to address something. So if you missed it here, okay, that happens. You went down this path. It'll come up again for them if it's really relevant. But just, I think, being able to create that space where it's okay to just sort of miss it sometimes, because you will, because we're human and that's just what happens. But being able to pick it up at some other point when it's really relevant for them, I think is helpful.
I have a reframe. I just thought of it as Lauren was talking, but I have students who are preparing for their final clinical demonstration, and there's this slide following their video clips, and a lot of them had what went wrong, like, to list what the other clinical choice points were. And it was like, well, you did something really good here, which is why you've put it in your PowerPoint in this presentation. And so we've been having a conversation about choice points. When you're in the session, the choice points that you see could be X, Y, and Z, and you pick one of those. And yet when you go watch the video again, maybe you see A, B, and C were also choice points, and that's okay. And you can always revisit them. Mm-hmm. You know, we're at an institution that values video recording our sessions, so we get to watch them over again. And we can go back in and say, gosh, I was reflecting on that video and this really stuck out for me. Can we go back to that, or can we touch that again? And so thinking about, instead of missed moments, choice points, and that there are multiple and we can always revisit them.
You remind me of something I read by Michael White, where he talked about that very thing, going back, that some things are just better discovered in hindsight rather than in foresight, right? And so rather than characterizing it as, oh, I missed the mark or something like that, it's just some things just show up in hindsight much better than they would in the moment, right? And so this is just this kind of acknowledging that, you know, hey, we're just going to discover new things in hindsight, and that's okay.
Yeah, I really like, you know, I can, what Veronica, what you're saying about how to work with choice points and And then when you can work with students to reflect on choice points, what helped you to make this decision rather than thinking you did it wrong? But let's explore what were the factors that helped you to make this decision. And I've had actually pretty recently a student tell me, you know, I was working with him and I was with a client and he felt to me like he was on the brink of tears and I didn't want to make him cry. And so she asked a very like heady sort of cognitive question, and we're doing some supervision in EFT and an emotionally focused therapy, and we explored why it was she sort of felt protective over him, and she sort of felt like she just didn't want to push him there. And it was interesting because I asked her, you know, how did it feel in the room? And she said, you know, it felt heavy. Like he wanted to be able to go there. And she felt like she wanted to sort of protect him from that. And so when we sort of watched it and we, you know, we played this tape back 3 or 4 different times, reflecting on it and came up with some other ideas how she could, you know, when she's faced with that choice point again, what is coming up for her that's going to take her down one road, and also what might she try in the future. And so hindsight sometimes helps us to discover ways of doing things differently.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think even what Bryson was saying, that by sort of revisiting those choice points, I think you can even sort of intertwine that person and the therapist in there. So mm-hmm. You took this route because why? Okay, so you didn't want him to cry. So what was that in you that made you feel like you had to be protective over him? Like, why did you feel protective over him? Or for other clients, you may not have felt quite as protective. So what was sort of activated for you? Like, is this sort of like a trigger for you in some way? And I think that sort of, if we're thinking about person to the therapist as more of a developmental process, that's when we can sort of introduce like, okay, well, that comes up for you. So what's going on? Can you manage your own anxiety or your own stuff when mm-hmm. that comes up?
And an experiential process. Mm-hmm. Walking them back through mm-hmm. that. What was it like for you? How were, you know, what is coming up for you? What is contributing to that? Sure. It's then experiential. And to me, my bias is then it's more lasting.
Well, and you guys gave me a great segue right into borrowing from an article by, I'm going to call it Joan and Murphy, and I think it's 2007, and they kind of laid out, and this is kind of from the postmodern perspective, they went through like collaborative language, narrative, and the feminist lens in regards to self of the therapist, and they kind of laid out 3 essential tasks in the use of self of the therapist, and kind of from this postmodern perspective. But the first one is this increasing of self-awareness, where they kind of refer to Virginia Satir and also Tom Anderson about this experiential approach to self-awareness. Both of them felt that was very important. And I'm also going to throw in maybe Dan Siegel. I use his book, The Mindful Therapist, when I teach practicum. And I love his metaphor of this window of tolerance. This, you know, how, you know, if somebody's taking us out of our window of tolerance, we're trying to bring them back into our window of tolerance. And being really aware of how that's playing out in the room. But how do you talk about, and you just did a good job, but maybe some more about how do you talk about the here and now or the experiential in therapy?
I think one of our biggest sources of information is our body and the mind-body connection, the mind-emotional connection, the body-emotional connection. Like, so I'll ask sort of, somatic type questions, right? Body driven questions. Where do you feel it in your body? Is it tense? Does it feel warm? Does it feel soft? Is it tender? Because I'm wanting to try and connect people to the experience. And I think our bodies operate as tremendous sources of information that often go overlooked. You know, lots of people that work with trauma and things, there's been extensive research that do sort of somatization type work to help people not forget what it feels like when their bodies are calm, when their parasympathetic nervous system is actually working and helping to calm the heart rate, because then you're much more aware and present and mindful. So I think the body and using body questions is a is a really great way to start that conversation.
I like being able to walk students back through what that experience was like. So what was it like being in the room with this person? So what did you feel when you were asking this particular question? I know a little bit about you, and so what was that like, and having to be in here, be present with these particular people, things of that nature. So I personally like being able to go to and walk back through it, I guess, more experientially, and being able to talk with them about it, and then bring in like, okay, so, but right now you seem a little nervous. You seem a little anxious in being able to talk about that. So what's going on for you? And things of that nature. So I personally enjoy walking people back through that experience to talk a bit more about it, or even watching video and being able to see them do that and then describe to me what it is that they're feeling now that we're in session, or that we're in supervision rather, and talking about what's going on for them.
Yeah, I would echo probably what both Lauren and Bryson have said, maybe adding to it role plays, which I think people don't like.
But that's an interesting discussion. We should talk about why people don't like role play.
Yeah.
But I think
the dreaded role.
Even if you can't recreate what that exact moment was in the room, you can recreate what it's like to be a therapist with couples or with individuals or with families in a way that allows you to sort of navigate therapy when you can stop and say like, okay, what happened there? Or you can say like, you turn to your colleague and say, I'm getting really flooded right now in this role play and I don't know what that's about. And you can sort of like walk through that in real time, and then they can jump back in it and have a different experience of maybe going to the place they weren't going to go, or to the place that they, maybe they were avoiding or something like that. So I like role plays.
Mm-hmm. All right. So another task, one of these of the three essential tasks in this article was the idea of developing self-knowledge. And they describe this as critically reflecting on one's values, biases, assumptions around gender, race, culture, sexual orientation, class, and disability. And I'm going to add maybe power operations or, power of the therapist. And in this idea of, you know, being really, at least from the postmodern perspective, of not reproducing, normalizing judgment, or not, you know, kind of doing those kinds of things. So any comments or thoughts about developing self-knowledge, or how that came about for you guys? Or
I can just talk about, I think one experience, it feels like probably what resonates most for me would just to give an example. But I started out seeing couples at the VA down in San Diego, and I early on felt like my value as a couple therapist was directly linked to whether or not I was able to keep a couple together. And I think I had a very large part of me who wanted to keep couples together. And so needless to say that really strained me. it was through a lot of processing about why that was coming up for me, why that felt important to me, why my value as a therapist was connected to that feeling, and some really good supervision to help me understand that sometimes couples choosing to break up isn't a bad outcome. And so I think I had to like get faced with my own bias, and it showed up and started to have an impact prior to me feeling like I could see it like that. So it was already in operation, and it was only in, you know, down the road where I felt I could really take a look at it. And yeah.
I think for me, it showed up really early on, again, because of the place that I was trained. So social justice was a large part of what they were focused on doing. It came when we had to do sort of like a clinical demonstration the end of our first quarter. I remember getting a family, and in this sort of enactment, the son in the family was gay. And so trying to work with his family, and they were African-American. And so they were like, yeah, you know, you as a black woman, you know what's going on. And I'm like, yeah, of course I do. And I like stopped and I was like, wait, no, I don't know what that's about for you. So I know what it's like for me. I know what it would be like for my family. I could assume what it's like culturally, but I don't know what that's like. And so I think that was the first time I was sort of hit with like, oh, okay, well, I can't make these sorts of assumptions. And what I hold as value and what I hold as truth is just for me. And so it's been sort of brought, it was brought up time and time again, and it was very explicit with some of the supervision that I got. So some things around family and family orientation or family actually formation, what that looked like. And so being explicitly told like, no, this is what it's looking like your values are, and it's coming very strongly, or it's coming across very clearly what that is like. And so not wanting to impose my own values and my own beliefs on any of my clients, I think just through the process of supervision was really, really imperative for me, because I wasn't aware that all of these things I had sort of huge and very strong values. And
I think I'm still in some sort of developmental process in terms of sort of locating myself. And I think that comes up in the supervision that I do. I think right now I'm in that place of, I can see these larger social discourses and social contexts like working and at play. And sometimes I don't know what to do about it in session. And so I think that comes up in the supervision that I do also. So a lot of my training was under Dr. Carmen Knudsen-Martin and Doug Hunegard, looking at gender and power. And so I see sort of gender at play, and then really trying to walk through that with my supervisees about like, how might you be aligning with the male partner? How might this experience be silencing to the wife, while also staying true to what their theoretical orientations are? And I've had some struggles in that. I've had some students that I've worked with who, following like larger discussions, not supervision discussions, but larger discussions on gender and power, said they felt disgusted by the way the conversation went talking about men, and that women should know their place, and really feeling stuck in those moments about like, okay, so I know what to do when people are open to these conversations and when I can sort of walk through them, through these experiences with them. But when someone's really against it, and yet this is what I see, how do I hold both of those things at the same time? While also feeling more socially justice inclined of like not wanting to maybe reinforce these larger discourses that are silencing to women and privileging to men. So I think, yeah.
Yeah. And when you find that answer, let's let us all know, please. Yeah. So, that's one of those things in process. And I was thinking about just sharing my own experience of the best way I can describe it is, kind of coming into my master's program with this, like a strong sense of certainty just about things and how the world worked, and having that really rocked, right? And then coming out of it with this embracing of uncertainty, which I really am grateful for now. It was a painful kind of process, but it really, I think, is so instrumental for me as a clinician, and just really helps with curiosity, which I think is so, so, so important when you're in these kind of, you know, situations. And like I said, I came from my training was very critically reflective, but with particular lenses, you know, like yours, Veronica, ours was very predominantly around kind of a feminist lens, patriarchy, and its effects, and then, you know, being exposed to other people and kind of expanding that lens a little bit, and the kind of producing some intersectionality, which was really, really helpful, and not just kind of putting one lens on and then, you know, putting certainty back into the game again, you know, just kind of, which I think can happen in some cases, you know, once somebody learns, it's like being a sophomore in undergrad and they learn you know, some of these ideas, then they see it everywhere, right? And then they just adopt kind of one lens. And I've gone through that process of trying them all on and then kind of, you know, embracing kind of intersectionality and curiosity and uncertainty, quite honestly, and about myself, about people, about people's lives. And I found that to be very valuable.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Because we started out the program talking about like perfectionism, and I think we can all resonate that that shows up a lot for the students that we are supervising.
And us. I mean, it's all PhD yes. students. Yeah. You don't get there without some real bias toward yes. perfectionism. Yeah.
And so I wonder, because you were talking about uncertainty, and I guess that's my own like person of the therapist, right? That uncertainty and perfectionism do not get along well.
No.
Like perfectionism doesn't like to be in uncertainty, that's just really ruffling of feathers. And so I wonder, like, how do you support your students in maybe in exploring some of those uncertainties in the face of perfectionism being there?
Well, I think there's just a strong, we live in a culture where it's very strong to have all the answers, right? And then so if you can somehow make, and you guys both, you've talked about going covert, and I call it going underground, right? This idea, and if you can somehow create space where it's okay not to have all the answers, right, then you can really begin to have those kinds of conversations.
And I think you can expand it to make it relational, whether that's with a client or supervisee or daily life, right? Like, it's sort of like I'll say, you know, I guess I'm having a reaction right now. It feels like you're asking me to have an answer for you, and I don't have that answer. How is that for you to hear, right? You talk about expanding the window of tolerance. They're coming to you saying, give me an answer, whether it's a student or a client, and your sort of response is, I don't have that answer for you. And then you make it relational. Like, yeah.
Yeah, and the greatest thing I can do sometimes with a supervisee or a trainee is just to say, I don't know. You know, I don't know. But let's try and figure it out, right? And then I can not have to be this position of like, I can model, so to speak, like not having all the answers, and that it's okay. And I'm seemingly in this position of authority, and I'm your supervisor, and I'm sitting here with you saying, I have no idea, you know, and I think that, you know, it goes a long way, quite honestly. Yeah. Okay. So was that helpful? Mm-hmm. Okay. let's go to the third task. The third task this article produced was about, they thought it was very important to situate the self in a therapeutic context. And they mean, and they were referencing the idea of self-disclosure. They were talking about how certain models, and I think the feminist model is the one that would say you can't not bring yourself to the work, right? And that even in the questions that you ask, the things like you guys, choice points you mentioned, all of that is a product of who we are and how we're situated and all of that. And so, so the feminist model would say it's very, very important to situate yourself in this therapeutic contest. And the way they do that is through self-disclosure in a lot of ways. And I even read an article one time by kind of a postmodern feminist therapist where she had said, and I forget the author, sorry about that, but she had said that she's really upfront in the beginning that I am a feminist therapist, working with couples, that I am a feminist therapist. This is my perspective and my lens, and I want you to be really aware of that before we even start the work. And when I say that to some people, they're like, "Oh, you know, don't do that." And then other people are like, okay, you know. And so I guess I'm wondering, how do you, all of you, handle self-disclosure? How do you talk about it with your trainees and supervisees? And how are you managing it yourself?
Okay. So I think that self-disclosure can be one of the most potent ways to connect with clients, and one of the most sort of relational ways that we can be with our clients. So who I am is who I am, and I always come in being Lauren. But I think being able to connect with our clients on a deeper level sometimes requires self-disclosure. But I think when it comes to talking with trainees about how or when to self-disclose, I think I always am curious about like why are they self-disclosing? Are you Are you doing that so that you can sort of relieve your own anxiety about what's going on in the room at that particular time? Are you not comfortable with silence in the room? Because I've noticed that a couple of times, like, just want to fill the room up with all of these words, and I'm going to sort of just self-disclose so we can have something else to talk about. So is it therapeutic in what you're doing? There has to be some sort of purpose behind it. But I feel like to not self-disclose, you're not relating to this person, because these are some of the more intimate details of someone's life. And this is probably going to be one of the more intimate sort of relationships that they have. And so for me not to say anything about who I am, where I'm located, I think is, it doesn't really bridge the gap between us that can really be there. And that typically is there for a number of reasons, through power, through what have you. But I think to not self-disclose is sort of a loss. But then checking in with yourself as to why you felt the need to self-disclose when you did, I think is sort of where I come from with that.
Yeah, I would agree definitely with Lauren that I self-disclose in therapy, and I self-disclose in supervision, that I think those are useful things. But I always try to remain mindful of, like, why am I self-disclosing at this time? And I would say that I probably have a tendency to self-disclose less. I think I often silence myself, that I don't think it would be useful, or I worry so much about that it would take up too much space that I choose not to self-disclose. And I think that's something that I've been trying to work on more, because the feedback from my supervisees is that you're just always so cool, calm, and collected. And it's like, well, no, that's, you know, or that you always have the answers, or that you, you know, when in actuality, it's sort of like I create answers. My husband tells me this too, that I don't like not having the answer. So I make up answers, because not having an answer would feel really scary, right? To not be perfect would be really scary. So mm-hmm. I think that's my own self of the supervisor, self of the therapist work. Trying to delve.
I see an article there we can write.
Yeah. Figuring out how to self-disclose. I think a lot of that too came with my experiences early on in my clinical training, working at a clinic that would describe their population as chronically and severely mentally ill, with a high occurrence of involvement in the criminal justice system, and having family members who worked in criminal justice system, this idea of, like, don't tell people about yourself because they'll come and get you. And I had this real fear that if people knew too much about me, that I would be in danger. And I think maybe at an emotional level that it still feels risky sometimes if people know too much about me, that maybe it's not like physical danger that I'll be in, but like that these are sort of uncharted territories, showing those parts of myself. So I think I'm still trying to figure that out, but I try to sort of walk that through and be transparent about that experience with my supervisees and the students that I work with.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think the term that's coming to mind is like functionality. You know, I think I'm asking questions. What is the function of the self-disclosure at this point? You know, who's it servicing? Is it servicing me, the clinician, or me, the supervisor? Is it servicing the client in some way? Like, those are the answers my internal monologue I'm sort of trying to answer for myself, around functionality, which I think we've all talked about. But I do think, like, our internal process and our own feelings can sometimes work really well in the therapeutic context. Like, if I'm having a reaction to something or I'm feeling conflicted, I had a supervisor, Lisa Palmer, who said to me, you know, she said at one point, she said, you know, let your inside voice be your outside voice. Let that part of you that feels conflicted or messy or confused or having some reaction, to let that part of you speak. Because it if it's attuned, it can be, you know, very therapeutic, very helpful. So I think I err on the side. I mean, I don't have anything against self-disclosure, but I certainly have that functionality part where I want to ask myself, you know, who is it servicing and what is it servicing?
Yeah, I something I kind of, the metaphor I use with my supervisees or trainees is this idea of this, there's a center to every conversation, and kind of, at least in narrative practice, there's this idea of like decentered but influential. And But there's a center to every conversation, and we hope that our clients or those who seek our help or consultation are centered in these conversations that we have. But my experience also is that they'll ask us or invite us into the center as well. It's just my job not to camp out there, right? And that's the kind of the way that I describe it. But I'll be asked and invited into that center, and I want to honor that in however way they want me to do that. And you know, outside of advice giving and stuff like that, you know, just these common things. But I'm not afraid of self-disclosure, because I just think it's pretty prevalent. So, go ahead.
Can I say something really quick? So, with what Bryson was saying and making that inside voice sort of outside, so making the implicit, I guess, explicit, that would be a huge part of person of the therapist, like using your own experience of what's going on and being able to use that to inform what you'll do therapeutically. So if you are feeling sort of anxious about something, like what's going, so I'm feeling this, what's happening right now? Cause I feel like we're connected. So I wanted to check in with you to see what's going on. And I think, Dr. Aponte would really sort of push that piece, like use that, because if you are connected with your clients, you can feel what they're feeling in a sense, and you can use that, in the room.
Which is a wonderful tool, and I adopted it from reading Harlene Anderson and her work around collaborative language, and she calls it making the private public, right? And in a very tentative way, like not as truth or as from a place of authority, but just, hey, I'm sensing this, or I'm thinking this, or have you thought about this? And just kind of this really tentative way, and I've used that in my own practice with great success, yeah. So yeah, thank you. So that's it, guy. We're at our end. So thank you and welcome, Lauren. And will you come back for our next roundtable?
Absolutely.
Awesome. Absolutely. Okay. We've been having some conversations about what we're going to talk about next. I don't know. Does anybody, just for our listeners, have any ideas you want to throw out there? Maybe they can respond.
I would love to get feedback and see if we could do, if people feel like it would be helpful to do a session around like sort of the idea of like shopping for a therapist, you know. Yeah. I think one of maybe our blind spots is that we're all in the field, amongst the field, and been in the field in multiple contexts. So it maybe goes overlooked that like some people shop for therapists and they need to know or would like to know some of the ways that they could do that. Maybe even the difference in degrees, like what's different about a social worker versus a psychologist versus a therapist versus psychiatry, as well as like sort of giving them some freedom about some of the things that they're allowed to ask as a client going in to a session, maybe about where a therapist locates themselves, you know, socially, model specific, you know, all the way down to insurance questions and some like real practical things, like what's the difference between an agency at a nonprofit and a private practice, and how do I ask my therapist to be on sliding scale, or you know,
what is sliding scale?
right. Well, it is sliding scale, or but all of those things, I think that would be I don't know, for all the listeners out there, if they feel like that would be helpful, I would love us to maybe have a conversation about that.
I think that would be great. So yeah. You heard it here first, listeners. That'll be our next podcast. So we'll talk about, it'll be for the people searching for a therapist. So that's our show. If you want to contact us, you, as always, send me an email at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. We have a website at theradicaltherapist.com. We're on Instagram at @theradicaltherapist and on Twitter at @therad. They only give you so many characters, so it's the Rad Therapist. So follow us on Twitter. And I'm going to have to do some reverse psychology here. You're going to make me go into the psychology world, people. Do not go to iTunes and subscribe to the show. Do not go to iTunes and rate and review the show. But just don't do that. So maybe that'll work. What do you think? As always, thank you for listening to the show. My name is Chris Hoff, and this has been The Radical Therapist.